But another thing I want us to note tonight is that this is also a location where future events will take place. That just as these events happened in the past, there's a time in the future that events are going to take place in these places. Okay, and we're going to consider one of the main places we're going to consider tonight is a place where there is one of the major events of the future will take place there. All right, so as we get this slideshow up, I don't know if it's up yet. There we go. We're on Bible geography, the hill country, and we're in calling this part three because I had part one, but I split it into two parts, so this is now effectively part three. All right, so we're going to be looking at, really, this is the central hill country. I have southern hill country there, but the central hill country. And so we have two areas to look at tonight, the hill country of Ephraim and Manasseh and the Jezreel Valley. The central mountain range is divided into several sections here, six sections, the Negev, the hill country of Judah, the wilderness of Judah, the hill country of Ephraim and Manasseh, the Jezreel Valley, and the Galilee. Okay, so the hill country of Ephraim and Manasseh is what we'll look at first. So again, let's just review our longitudinal zones. What do we call this area along the coast? The coastal plain, right? And then through here? All of this. All right, it's the central mountain range. Central mountain range all through here. And then this longitudinal zone right here, Jordan River, Dead Sea, Sea of Galilee. Okay, Jordan Valley or the Rift Valley. And then on this side, Transjordan Mountains, and then over here, the Eastern Desert, okay? And so as we go through this, we're here in these central mountains, and the first area we looked at is this area down here called the Negev, which the major city is Beersheba in that area. Then we get to the hill country of Judah, which is in here, which is Jerusalem, Bethlehem, Hebron, those areas. Just to the east of that, we have this deserty area, which we looked at last week as well, that is the wilderness of Judah here along the Dead Sea. And then we have the hill country of Ephraim and Manasseh, which is basically this area south. Okay, the Jezreel Valley's up here, and it's up here. So it's this area south of the Jezreel Valley and north of the hill country of Judah. Okay, Mount Carmel kind of cuts down into it, and it's in here in this area. And then the Galilee is this set of hills, mountains up here to the north. So we're going to be looking at the hill country of Ephraim and Manasseh. Let's see if that's kind of a political map of the area today, from Eilat here all the way up. So you're going through this area. This is really the area we're focused. A lot of this, if you notice, that we're going to be looking at is an area that's technically called the West Bank. Okay, that is an area that was occupied by Israel after their being invaded years ago, and so they keep the peace in this area, so that's the area a lot of what we're looking at. So here we're looking at Jordan Valley, okay, in this map, and then we've got this area here, like one of the cities we're going to look at is Shiloh, okay, and so we'll be considering some of these towns that are in this hill country, and you can see this is rugged area, this is a lot of hills, and we'll see that from some of the illustrations as well. The boundaries of the hill country of Ephraim and Manasseh. Now, we're lumping the two of them together as one geographical area, but the two tribes did have separate inheritances within this area. The hill country of Ephraim and Manasseh lies between the plain of Sharon on the west and the Jordan Rift on the east. So here's the Jordan Rift, but if we were to go to this side, if we were to back up, for example, okay, so we have the Jordan Rift here. It lies between there and the Sharon Plain over here on the coast. All right. It lies between the Jezreel Valley on the north and Bethel on the south. So Bethel kind of marks the southern edge of it. And then the hill country of Ephraim and Manasseh is about 40 miles long and about 27 miles wide. Okay, so again, this isn't a huge area. This land of the Bible, ancient Israel, is about the size of New Jersey. So it's not a massive place. Important geographical areas in the hill country of Ephraim and Manasseh, and we're going to consider these. We have Mount Ebal and Mount Gerizim. All right, so I'll again ask you to open your Bibles. There may be some of these references we don't look at, but I'm going to try to look at a good bit of them. But Deuteronomy chapter 11, we find a reference to these two mountains. Deuteronomy 11:29 says, "And it shall come to pass, when the Lord thy God hath brought thee into the land whither thou goest to possess it, that thou shalt put the blessing upon Mount Gerizim and the curse upon Mount Ebal." All right. And they not on the other side, Jordan, but by the way, where the sun goeth down in the land of the Canaanites, which dwell in the campaign over against Gilgal besides the plains of Morah. For ye shall pass over Jordan and go in to possess the land which the Lord your God giveth you. And what they were called to do was to read the book of the law, and there would be blessings and cursings written or read from these mountains. And so we have these two mountains, Mount Ebal and Mount Gerizim, okay? And so we're going to take a look at this. Here is a view of Mount Gerizim. If we could turn the lights on the wall down. Is anybody up there? Yeah, just the ones that are on the wall, if we could turn those down a little bit so that we can, this contrast on the pictures will be a little bit better. Good. Okay, so you can see Mount Gerizim in the distance. This is the village of Nablus down here, okay, that modern Palestinian city of Nablus is down at the base of this hill. And these hills are right near each other, so you're going to see that, I think, in some of the photos we have. But this is the place where the blessings were read from. The Samaritans believed that the proper place of worship. Remember in the time of Jesus, the woman at the well asked Jesus this question. If you go to John chapter 4, we'll find a reference to this. John chapter 4, Jesus' famous statement in regard to this question, actually. So John chapter 4, verse 19, the woman at the well saith to him, Sir, I perceive that thou art a prophet. Our fathers worshipped in this mountain, and ye say that in Jerusalem is the place where men ought to worship. So after he mentions the fact and notices the fact that she is living in a sinful relationship with a man, she says, I think you're a prophet. Let me ask you a theological question. Our people say the right place to worship is to worship on Mount Gerizim, and your people say it's in Jerusalem. Jesus saith unto her, Woman, believe me, the hour cometh when ye shall neither in this mountain nor yet at Jerusalem worship the Father. Ye worship ye know not what. We know what we worship, for salvation is of the Jews. But the hour cometh, and now is, when the true worshippers shall worship the Father in spirit and in truth, for the Father seeketh such to worship him. So the context of proper worship being in spirit and in truth is in answer to this. Is Mount Gerizim or Jerusalem the right place to worship? And what Jesus' answer is there's days coming that we're not going to have this debate about which place. It's an issue of worshiping God in spirit and in truth. God is a spirit, and they that worship him must worship him in spirit and in truth. He's not bound to a place. He's a spirit. Okay? And so therefore, when you worship him, you must worship him in spirit and in truth. In other words, the issue here is that worship is not a rote, memorized kind of set of things you do. That your spirit has to be engaged in it, but it also has to be in truth. The call today seems to be to worship in spirit. Okay, most churches in America are going toward, let's make sure we worship in spirit. But unfortunately, a lot of them are not asking whether they're worshiping in truth. And a lot of churches, when they discuss their worship, are discussing whether or not the worship is pleasing to the worshipers, which is a nonsense question in the context of worship. Because when you're worshiping God, and this would have been understood throughout all of human history until fairly recently, the question wasn't, are the worshipers pleased? The question was, is God pleased? Or even in the case of the pagans, are the gods pleased? All right, because what's the point of worshiping if God doesn't accept it? You see, and again, I think it kind of illustrates what our God is or who our God is. And that is, in a lot of cases, the people are pleased by this kind of worship because this kind of worship pleases them. In other words, if the test of worship is how good I feel when I walk out of the service, then am I worshiping God or am I worshiping the way I feel after the service is over? Now, don't misunderstand me, okay? I am not saying, on the other hand, that our spirit shouldn't be engaged. I think this is one of the things, for example, that the Reformation attempted to do was to call out the fact that the ritualism, okay, what some have called the smells and bells of Roman Catholicism, are that you got double problems here. You have rote ritual, which is not being done necessarily by people in spirit. They're just learned the motions to go through. And on the other hand, they're not doing it in truth because in the New Testament, we have no commands to offer incense and do some of these and sprinkle holy water on things and do some of these kinds of things that are really borrowed from paganism in some cases, the holy water, certainly. And so there you had neither spirit nor truth. But one of the things that the Reformation was trying to recapture was this idea that worship needs to be in spirit. And our church is pretty conservative about our worship. And I'm using this word in a very specific way, okay? Let me explain what I mean by conservative worship. By conservative, what we mean is that we believe that biblically, Christianity is something that is handed down. And so we're trying to conserve biblical Christianity. So when I'm saying we're conservative, I usually when people ask me what style of worship service does your church have, I say we have a conservative worship service. I don't say traditional, because there isn't a specific tradition we're following. Does that make sense? In other words, Lutherans have a specific tradition. Episcopalians have a specific tradition. This is their denomination, and their denomination has a set tradition. Okay, our Baptist church is independent. We're not necessarily trying to follow a particular tradition. So we're not traditional in the sense of that. Now, when people say traditional, they usually mean that it's not contemporary, and so I understand that. But I say conservative because we're trying to... There are some wonderful, wonderful hymns that have been written over the years, and I think one of the greatest crimes, if you could, and not literally a crime, but one of the greatest losses to Christianity is the fact that there are so many young Christians today who do not know those hymns. And we've got hymns that are 1,000 years old, and we're going to give them up for songs that are being written by false teachers in Hillsong or somewhere. And that's ridiculous, okay? All right, and some of you are looking at me a little surprised. The denomination that's linked with Hillsong, and Hillsong music's very popular, has aberrant theology, okay? Let's say that. They don't have good theology. And their songs reflect it. When you see their songs, if you interpret it with your good theology, sometimes they might make sense to you, but that their actual theology is aberrant. And so therefore, we're not going to use, even if the Mormons write a great hymn, I'm probably not going to use a Mormon hymn, if you follow what I'm saying, because enough of their, I'm not going to use them. The Mormons might write some good books on child rearing, but I'm not going to use it in our Sunday school classes. You follow what I'm saying? Because I'm not going to lean people toward false teaching in that regard. So when I say conservative, what we mean is that we want the worship to be conserving biblical truth. But on the other hand, we also recognize that throughout all of church history, Christianity has been open to a new hymn being written. There was a point at which A Mighty Fortress Is Our God was a new hymn. Or I Sing the Mighty Power of God was a new hymn. And so, therefore, what we say is we want to be conservative and look at what does the Bible say worship should be like, and therefore conform to that. And so it needs to be in spirit and in truth. And so for a church that's conservative, one of the things that we can fall into is a rut that says, we don't want to get too emotional in our worship, because that might lead to something problematic. Now, don't misunderstand me. Emotionalism for its own sake, I'm not for emotionalism at all. I'm for our affections being drawn toward the Lord, and our spirits being engaged when we worship. If you get done singing a hymn, and I've found myself doing this at times where I'm thinking about my sermon or whatever, and if you get done singing a hymn and you forgot that you sang it, then you probably didn't worship in spirit and in truth. I don't mean that if I asked you a quiz, what songs did we sing this morning, that you'd have to remember them all. But if, 20 seconds after we quit singing the hymn, I said to you, what did we just sing? And you say, I don't know, because all I was doing was reading words on the wall, then you're not worshiping in spirit and in truth. It might have been truth, but Lord willing, we're not choosing anything that's not truth to sing. By God's grace, we try not to do that. But on the other hand, my spirit should be engaged in it. My spirit's not engaged if I'm not thinking about what I'm singing, if my heart's not rejoicing in what I'm singing. And sometimes it's not just rejoicing. Sometimes my heart is being drawn into a different godly emotion. So if I sing, O Sacred Head Now Wounded, that's not an uplifting song. It's not one you're going to use at a revival meeting, if you follow me. But yet it is very biblical, and the emotions of it, we ought to have somber emotions about the sufferings of Christ. Okay? Or one of my favorite hymns as a teenager, this sounds kind of strange, but one of my favorite hymns in a church I was growing up in, we sang it quite frequently, and it was one of my favorite hymns as a teenager. Bearing shame and scoffing rude, in my place condemned he stood, man of sorrows. That's not a song that's like, yippity-yay, this is exciting, but yet it's very biblical for me to think that here my Savior bore my sins in his body on that tree. And I should think sober, somber thoughts about that. And so all of our being, if my spirit's engaged, that means, worshiping God isn't just about, yippee, hip, hip, hooray, happy, happy, joy, joy, I'm only happy, and that's all that ever happens. No, it's about It's about expressing all the right kinds of emotions. Sometimes that's sorrow for sin. Sometimes that's seriousness about the gospel and the sufferings of Christ. Sometimes that's joy and rejoicing in what God has done for me and the eternity that's prepared. Okay, but what we find here is that the Samaritans believed that on Mount Gerizim is where worship only properly happened. But Jesus corrected the woman at the well in that regard. Okay, here's the view from the top of Mount Gerizim. This is a village today called Balata. Archaeologists think this might be the ancient location of Shechem, but then it also might be Nablus. So they're both at the base of this hill. Today, the Samaritans have a Passover sacrifice site. There's still people called Samaritans. Did you know that? You have to understand where they come from. The Samaritans are people who, after the Assyrians conquered the northern kingdom of Israel and took them into captive, they had issues in the land, and we know this from the Old Testament. And so they sent back some Jews to relive in the land because their theory was that the gods are mad that they're not being worshipped, and so therefore we have to send their worshippers back there. Worshippers of the Lord back there, and it'll calm the gods down. This was, you know, the Assyrian reasoning. And so they sent back some Jews, but those Jewish people intermarried with Gentiles, so they were half Jewish and half Gentile. And that's why by the time of Christ, a few hundred years after this, 500 years after this, really 700 years after this, by the time of Christ, what we find is that you have these people who are half Jewish and half Gentile, and the Jews from Judea view them as half-breeds who are not worthy to be fellowshipped with. And the Samaritans by this time have their own religion, which has rejected the worship in Jerusalem, but is now focused on Mount Gerizim. It's taken some of the Dan and Bethel worship traditions, because remember they're from that northern kingdom, taken some of those traditions, and but yet mixed it with the Old Testament. And the Samaritans only accepted the first five books of Moses as scripture. They didn't accept the Psalms and the prophets and those kinds of things. So even today, the Samaritans have what's called the Samaritan Pentateuch. And there are some ancient copies of it, which are testimonies to us of the Old Testament, because they are basically the first five books of Moses. Okay, but the Samaritans still have a worship site here on Gerizim. And you can see these are sacrificial drains where they would slaughter the lamb for the Passover. And this is where the blood would drain out. Okay, so now you can see here we're looking toward Mount Ebal. Okay, with Nablus in the valley. And so Mount Ebal is where the curses were read. All right? The blessings were on Mount Gerizim, curses on Mount Ebal. But the ancient city of Shechem, which we're going to look at later, sat down here by these mountains. Mount Gilboa. We're going to look at another mountain here. Mount Gilboa. Okay, we got a little bit of a map. All right? And it might be a little. So we've got several mountains here marked. Mount Tabor's here in the north. The hill of Moriah's here. Mount Gilboa is a sort of small range of mountains here. It's toward the Jordan Valley, as you can see, and it's over here at this north edge of the hill country of Ephraim and Manasseh. It's Mount Gilboa. Okay, Mount Gilboa is located in the northeast section of the area of Manasseh on the southeastern edge of the Jezreel Valley. It's actually a ridge about 10 miles long, ranging from elevation from 500 to 1,500 feet above sea level. Mount Gilboa is most famous as the place where Saul died fighting the Philistines, 1 Samuel 31 records this for us. On the northeastern side of Mount Gilboa is the spring of En-Herod, where Gideon's men were tested. So on the northeastern side, En-Herod's spring, here's the spring of Herod. See that? So let's go there, because that's a well-known passage, Judges chapter 7. Remember, God calls Gideon to rescue the Israelites from the Midianites who had encamped in this. This is the Jezreel Valley, okay? This area here, this is the Jezreel Valley. They had encamped in this area, and so he's assembling his army over here. And what we find in verse 6, when Jerubbaal, who is Gideon, and all the people that were with him, rose up early and pitched beside the well of Herod, so that the host of the Midianites were on the north side of them, by the hill of Moreh in the valley. So here's the hill of Moreh, so they're encamped over here. And the Lord said unto Gideon, the people that are with thee are too many for me to give the Midianites into their hands. Lest Israel vaunt themselves against me, saying, mine own hand has saved me. Your army's too big. If you win with this many men, then you'll think you won on your own. So I'm going to shave down your army a little bit. Now therefore, go to, proclaim in the ears of the people, saying, whosoever is fearful and afraid, let him return and depart early from Mount Gilead. So here's what he says. If you're afraid to go out to battle, then you can go home. There'll be no shame in this. I wonder who the first guy was to walk out of line. But you can imagine that once one person starts leaving, somebody else is like, he's going, I'm going. I don't really want to fight these Midianites. There's 100,000 of these people. I don't really want to get into this battle. And there returned of the people 20 and 2,000, and there remained 10,000. So 22,000 leave, and 10,000 are left. And the Lord said unto Gideon, the people are yet too many. Bring them down unto the water, and I will try them for thee there. And it shall be that of whom I say unto thee, this shall go with thee, the same shall go with thee. And of whomsoever I say unto thee, this shall not go with thee, the same shall not go. So he brought down the people unto the water. And the Lord said unto Gideon, everyone that lappeth of the water with his tongue as a dog lappeth, him shalt thou set by himself. Likewise, everyone that boweth down upon his knees to drink. And the number of them that lapped, putting their hand to their mouth, were 300 men. But all the rest of the people bowed down upon their knees to drink water. And the Lord said unto Gideon, by 300 men that lapped will I save you and deliver the Midianites into thine hand, and let all the people, all the other people go, every man into his place. So he says, there's only 300 men here who knelt down and pulled the water up to their face. Everybody else stuck their face in the water of the spring and drank, and those you can send home. And so here at this spring of Herod is where Gideon's men were tested, right here in this Jezreel Valley. And a lot of events, biblical events, a lot of battles take place here in the Jezreel Valley. And so we find that that's the location, the spring of Herod, right here by Mount Gilboa. So let's see. So here's a view. You can see a little bit of the ridge that is Mount Gilboa here, and you can see the valley out in the distance. All right. That's not the modern spring of Herod. That's a pool. But there is a modern park in Israel that is at the location of the spring site, if that makes sense. All right, so they've developed it into this nice park area, but it is the area, so you can get an idea, see the rolling hills there, and you can get an idea of kind of what it looks like. Obviously, the swimming pool was probably not there in Gideon's day, but a little bit of an idea of the geography, at least, of that spring of Herod where Gideon's men were tested. And then the Lord delivers, right? By the hand of the Lord, they're delivered. 300 men. They do that surprise attack, if you would, with the trumpets and with the lamps to make it seem like there are much greater numbers. And the Midianites panic. God sends panic on the Midianites. And they fight against each other, thinking that there's the enemy in the camp. And the Lord delivers them miraculously. That's Mount Gilboa. We'll get to Mount Carmel next, okay? Mount Carmel is a range that extends some 30 miles southeast into the hill country of Manasseh. Its highest elevation is 1,790 feet above sea level. I'm going to go back to a map here. I've got to go back a couple maps back, so if you'll be patient with me, I thought I'd put one in there. But actually, this area that juts out right here and that comes down this way, this range, is Mount Carmel. Okay, Mount Carmel's a range. It's not just one mountain. Let me see if I can find Mount Carmel. This would be the far edge of the Carmelite range, just over here. Okay? So there's Gilboa again. Mount Carmel. Now on Mount Carmel today, there's this statue. Who do you think that is? Knife, prophet under his foot. Okay, it's Elijah. Not really, it's a statue, but up there on Mount Carmel today. Mount Carmel is this range. It's there on the Mediterranean edge, and it's part of sort of part of the coastal plain, but it's not a plain. It's the mountain that juts out. Mount Carmel receives over 30 inches of rain annually and is very fertile. This is why it is used as a symbol of fertility in Song of Songs. Song of Songs, in Hebrew, the book is called Song of Songs, and so that's how I tend to refer to it. I know in our English Bibles it's Song of Solomon. But Song of Solomon, chapter 7, verse 5, it says, thine head upon thee is like Carmel, and the hair of thy head like purple, and the king is held in the galleries. So that word galleries there could be translated as trusses or tresses of hair, okay? So the idea here, the galleries is her hair flowing down. But in other words, this is very poetic, and it doesn't, Song of Songs doesn't always make an immediate sense to us, because we're like, your head is like Carmel. But the point is here, the beauty of this very, you know, very fertile mountain that's very green and lush is what her head is, the beauty of her head is being compared to. It doesn't translate completely for us into English because this is not, you know, how we romantically refer to things today, but that's exactly what it's saying. So Mount Carmel's beauty and its fertileness, its green lushness, is a metaphor for beauty. Several passes in the Carmel Range give access to the Jezreel Valley. The best known is the pass that runs past Megiddo. This is that old trunk road, okay, that runs past Megiddo. And again, I'm going to go back a few slides so we can kind of trace that old trunk road right here. So the old trunk road came up from Egypt, came along the Philistine plain, came along the plain of Sharon, came up here just south of Carmel, and it cut through at Megiddo into the Jezreel Valley, where it made its way over up this way toward the Galilee and up around the Sea of Galilee through the Horns of Hattin, and up that way, I think we might say that later. But and then it made its way up in towards Syria. So if you wanted to connect Asia with Africa, okay, the major African civilization being Egypt, you want to connect that with Syria up here, then you had to go through this trunk road, and that ran right by the city of Megiddo. And so this is one of the major passes in that Carmel Range. The most notable event on Mount Carmel was the contest between Elijah and the prophets of Baal, 1 Kings 18, 16 through 46. I won't read that whole passage, but I think you're aware of the passage, and that is that there's this contest where Elijah calls the prophets of Baal to Mount Carmel. You can see the Carmel Range here in the Jezreel Valley. He calls them there, and he says, we're going to have a contest, and we're going to see whether Baal is God or whether the Lord is God. And here's what we're going to do. We're going to set up an altar, and we're going to call for our God to bring down fire out of heaven. Now, you have to understand several things. Baal is the god of the thunderstorm. He's pitching this whole battle in favor of the prophets of Baal. In other words, he's giving them every advantage. All right? Fire from heaven, the god of the thunderstorm who throws lightning out of heaven, should be able to do that. That shouldn't be a problem. Second, he says, let's have the battle on one of the rainiest places in Israel. That's on top of a mountain. Okay, so elevation would help lightning, if you would, and the raininess, the fact that there's more storms here, and they get more rain, it's right off the coast. Everything is an advantage of Baal, but yet it's not coming. The prophets of Baal pray and pray, and then Elijah mocks them and says, maybe your God is out hunting, maybe he's not around. Maybe you better shout louder, right? And then what does he do is, the way he sets up his altar is sets up these stones, puts the sacrifice on it, digs a trench around it, covers it with water and water so that the trench is full of water. Now, I remember hearing one Bible teacher, false teacher, by the way, saying, well, you know what he really did is we know that the Middle East is famous for oil, and it wasn't really water, it was gasoline. And what Elijah did was he got a mirror and he reflected the sun. And you know how you can take a mirror and light a leaf on fire or something when you were a little boy, maybe, or a little, I don't know if little girls do that as commonly, maybe they do. Little boys tend to be pyromaniacs by nature. And, you know, you just light something on fire, and that he took something like that and just kind of like, maybe shout louder over there. And it burst into flames, and it was amazing. And that it was nothing more than basically a parlor trick. The fact is that the Bible doesn't say he poured gasoline out. He poured water on it. And in fact, when you read the biblical text, it says that it consumed the sacrifice, it consumed the water, and it consumed the stone altar. Even if you had gasoline, you're not going to burn stones up. Okay? And so, you know, people find ways to try to explain away what the Bible is setting forth as a very specific miracle. In other words, all that does is make Elijah a fraud who says, I can do better tricks. He's no more than one of the magicians from the court of Egypt then, if he's setting gasoline on fire with a mirror. Okay, but we see the Lord intervenes there and defeats the prophets of Baal on Mount Carmel. So that's the Carmelite Range. Looking at the Jezreel Valley there out in the distance. Here we can again see the Jezreel Valley. You can see a little airport out here. This, it's kind of hazy on this picture. It's a good picture, but I think just the way the projector's showing it on the wall. This area here, just to let you know how small things are in Israel, this is the Jezreel Valley, okay? But here's a little airport, and you got a hill out in the distance, but right here, that is Nazareth, modern Nazareth. So where Jesus grew up in the Galilee is on the north edge of the Jezreel Valley, and here we're standing on Mount Carmel, you know, from that perspective, and you can see Nazareth on that edge, Okay, so these things are really close. You can see that's not very far. If I said we're going to go out there, it might take a little while. You can see it's a city out in the distance. But that's not a long way away. All right, so things are very close together. And so here, this contest took place on Mount Carmel. And then miraculously, what does Elijah do? We find out that Jezebel is mad that all her favorite prophets got killed. And so she says, I take an oath that I'm going to kill Elijah. So what does he do? He flees. But one of the things we know he does is that the rain comes. And when the prophecy says that the rain's going to come, he runs across this valley and outruns the chariot across the valley, which is, you know, again, another miraculous thing. Important cities in the hill country of Ephraim and Manasseh. Okay, let's look at some important cities. One of them is Shiloh. Shiloh is located about 22 miles north of Jerusalem in the hill country of Ephraim. So here's a picture of Shiloh, what we call Tel Shiloh today, or ancient Shiloh. There's not really, you know, much here, but just a tel is a hill. So it's the hill that's the piles of ruins that we used to make up this city. Shiloh was the site of the tabernacle during the days of Joshua, Joshua 18:1, and during the period of the judges, Judges 18:31 and 21:12, and in the early days of Samuel, 1 Samuel 1:3. We'll look at that one. 1 Samuel 1:3. This is the introduction to the book of Samuel, the little boy Samuel, right? It's before he's born here in this verse. And this man went up out of his city yearly to worship and to sacrifice unto the Lord of hosts at Shiloh. And the two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, the priests of the Lord, were there. What we learn is that this man Elkanah goes up to worship the Lord at Shiloh, because from the days of Joshua on, the tabernacle where the Lord was worshipped, where the Ark of the Covenant was, and the altar of burnt offerings and all of those things, the central altar was at Shiloh. Okay, the hill country of Ephraim is very difficult to access from both east and west. It has no Shephelah. All right, you know how the hill country of Judah has this region, this transitional region from the coast called the Shephelah, where there's five valleys that get you up into the hill country. There's nothing like that to get into the hill country of Ephraim, so access to it is much more difficult. It's easier to access to get up into the hill country of Judah and then walk north, or to come from the Jezreel Valley and come south into it. But to get into it from the east or the west is much more difficult because of the way the mountains are set up. They're just not passes there. Okay, and since it has no Shephelah, it's hard to get into. Normally, this area was protected from direct invasions. This is one of the hardest areas to invade because it's so rugged. Which is probably why, in the early days of Joshua, as they're establishing their nation, they would choose this place in the middle of the mountains to set this up, because it's hard to invade. And you want to have your central altar in a place that's not going to be overrun all the time if you're having a battle. And so they put it in this place that would be a safe place. It was from Shiloh that the Ark was taken during the Battle of Aphek in 1067 B.C. In 1067 B.C., in 1 Samuel, we're already there. We'll go over to chapter 4. We find that the Israelites go out to battle against the Philistines. And the word of Samuel came to all Israel. Now, Israel went out against the Philistines to battle and pitched beside Ebenezer. And the Philistines pitched in Aphek. Remember, we talked about Aphek being right there on the edge of the coastal plain, and it's where the Philistines would stage their army before a battle. And the Philistines put themselves in array against Israel. And when they joined battle, Israel was smitten before the Philistines. And they slew of the army in the field about 4,000 men. 4,000 Israelites die. And when the people were come into the camp, the elders of Israel said, "Wherefore hath the Lord smitten us today before the Philistines? Let us fetch the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord out of Shiloh unto us, that when it cometh among us, it may save us out of the hand of our enemies." Again, they have this pagan idea about the Lord. If we bring the Lord's good luck charm, then we'll win the battle. Well, the problem is you've been worshiping idols and you've been disobeying the Lord, and God is chastening you. Bringing a good luck charm doesn't make God come with you. He's not tied to that ark. So the people sent to Shiloh that the thing might be that they might bring from thence the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord of Hosts, which dwelleth between the cherubims. And the two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, were there with the Ark of the Covenant of God. And when it came into the camp, all Israel shouted with a great shout, so that the earth rang again. The Philistines heard the noise and they were afraid. But what we find, verse 10, and the Philistines fought, and Israel was smitten, and they fled every man to his tent. There was a very great slaughter, and there fell of Israel 30,000 footmen, and the Ark of God was taken, and the two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, were slain in the battle. The Philistines beat them in the battle and capture the Ark of the Covenant and take it back to Philistia. They don't keep it for very long because plagues come upon them in keeping it, and eventually they send it back to Israel, but it never comes back to Shiloh. Okay? Never comes back to Shiloh. So again, keep in mind, this was not a good luck charm. It was not some supernatural talisman of some kind. This was the center of God's worship. And they needed to be worshiping God and obeying Him, not trying to have some kind of good luck charm. You know, I think we fall into this today, that sometimes our politicians and stuff think if they talk enough God talk at elections, you know, and just because we say God bless America doesn't necessarily mean God is going to bless America. God talk isn't what we're talking about here. All right. It's not, do I nod my head to God once every 4 years an election comes up? It's, do you follow the Lord? Do you love the Lord? Do you know the Lord? It's not enough to just have God talk. There's lots of Americans who know how to have God talk and don't know a thing about God or His word. We know from Psalm 78, verse 60, that it mentions the ark being taken out of Shiloh and the Lord removing it from there. Shechem. Shechem was located about 12 miles south of Shiloh. It's midway between Bedan and Beersheba, midway between the sea and the Jordan. Okay, so here's Shechem from Mount Gerizim. We've got the village of Nablus is over here. Balath is here to the right. One of those two, depending on which archaeologist you read, is the ancient location of Shechem, but it's in this valley either way. All right. Shechem was the first place Abraham stopped when he entered Canaan in Genesis chapter 12. Joseph was buried near Shechem, according to Joshua 24. Remember, after they come up out of Egypt, they bring the body of Joseph with them, because he had been buried there in Egypt, mummified probably, and buried there in Egypt. And Joshua 24 tells us they take his remains. 24:32 says, and the bones of Joseph, which the children of Israel brought up out of Egypt, buried they in Shechem, in a parcel of ground which Jacob bought of the sons of Hamor, the father of Shechem, for 100 pieces of silver, and it became the inheritance of the children of Joseph. And so what we find, again, the descendants of Joseph, their names are Ephraim and Manasseh. So in the hill country of Ephraim and Manasseh is where you would expect their ancestor to be buried. So he's buried there in Shechem. Gideon's son, Abimelech, attempted to set up a kingdom in Shechem, Judges 9. Now, that's always the funny thing to me with Gideon. You know, Gideon takes this credit himself, the sword of the Lord and of Gideon, right, in this battle. And then they want to make him a king. He wins this great battle over the Midianites. He says, no, don't make me a king, but do this favor for me. Pay me some tax, take up a tax, and pay me some gold. And then he takes an ephod and sets himself up like a Canaanite priest king. Okay, so he behaves like a Canaanite. And then he's got this son. You know, Gideon says, no, don't make me the king. But what is his son's name? Abimelech. You know what Abimelech means in Hebrew? My father is king. Avi means my father, and Melech means king. So why would you name your son, my father is king, if you don't want to be the king? And why would you think the son wants to try to rule? Because he saw dad do it and figured dad kind of turned it down, but I think we can consolidate power. And in Judges 9, we find this wannabe king, Abimelech, the son of Jerubbaal, went to Shechem unto his mother's brethren and communed with them and with all the family of the house of his mother's father, saying, speak, I pray you, in the ears of all the men of Shechem, whether it be better for you either that all the sons of Jerubbaal, which are 70 persons, reign over you, or that one reign over you. Remember also that I am your bone and your flesh. Here's that Hebrew idiom, flesh and bone, not flesh and blood. That's the Hebrew idiom, flesh and bone. And so what do we find? He says, is it better, our father Gideon reigned over you, but wouldn't it be better instead of having all the sons ruling to just have one person in charge? You know, he's a evil man who ends up trying to take power. And again, it illustrates the conflict of the days of the judges. What happens when Israel's leaders behave like Canaanites? Read the book of Judges so you see what happens. Okay, so this is the town of Shechem. All right, and give you an idea of, on the map here. Here is the Jezreel Valley. Okay, here is this area that makes up the hill country of Ephraim and Manasseh here. You can see Shechem is down here. Mount Ebal here, Mount Gerizim and Ebal are down there. Then we're going to see the town of Samaria, which is here. Shechem, Samaria. All right. Jeroboam the First made Shechem the capital of the northern kingdom after the death of Solomon. 1 Kings 12, we find, if we'll just briefly look there, that after the split between the kingdoms,
after Rehoboam foolishly tells the people he's going to work them harder than his father did, Jeroboam leads this revolt and takes away 10 of the tribes with him and sets up this northern kingdom of Israel. And what we find here in 1 Kings 12:25, and Jeroboam built Shechem and Mount Ephraim and dwelt therein and went out from thence and built Penuel. What we find is he sets this up as the capital of that northern kingdom. This is Jesus met the woman of the well, Jacob's well, in Shechem called Sychar, John 4. So we were talking about Mount Gerizim. She was asking, should we worship on Mount Gerizim? But she was living at this New Testament city called Sychar, which is actually ancient Shechem. Okay, right in the heart. This is the heart of Samaria, right? This is because Samaria is the old northern kingdom. And so this is exactly where in the New Testament Jesus met with the woman of the well as he passed through this area. The town of Samaria. Samaria was on a 300-foot hill about 7 miles north of Shechem. Samaria was made the capital of the northern kingdom by Omri, who bought the hill from Shamer. 1 Kings 16:24. So we just turn over a few pages here in this. 1 Kings 16:24. Omri is not a very well-known king. I mean, if you ask the average Christian, who's Omri? They're going to say some guy in the Old Testament, if they know that, right? 1 Kings 16:24. And he bought the hill of Samaria of Shamer for 2 talents of silver and built on the hill and called the name of the city which he built after the name of Shamer, the owner of the hill, Samaria. So he names this city Samaria. But Omri wrought evil in the eyes of the Lord and did worse than all that were before him. He's not a good king. Interestingly, he has a son who becomes worse. His name is Ahab. Okay, but one of the things Omri tries to do, why would you move your capital from here to here? Well, one of the things he's doing is he's moving it closer to the valley and he's moving it closer to the coast. He's moving it closer to the trunk highway. He's trying to, you can see these old routes. See that route that comes up from the old trunk highway up into Samaria? Passes through here by Megiddo. He's trying to move his capital closer to international influences. And the other proof of this is, if you want to make, you know, you're this tiny, tiny little kingdom of Israel. The glories of Solomon are long gone. You're this tiny little kingdom of Israel. But yet you do have around you, you know, these highways and some of these things that you have control over that gives you some importance. But to really have some importance, you need to make some international relations. And so one of the things he does is he reaches out to a very powerful kingdom that's actually up here. If you look on the little map here, it's up here. It was known as Phoenicia. And he marries his son to a princess from Phoenicia. She's a young, lovely lady named Jezebel. Obviously not lovely. She's an evil woman who tries to convince the Israelites they should worship Baal rather than the Lord. In other words, that was probably also part of that policy of, come on, let's get with it. You know, Baal worship is a lot more in vogue in this area. Baal worship's going on all throughout this area. You know, all throughout here is Baal worship. And you're sticking to your old worshiping of the Lord at Dan and Bethel. And what's with all that? You got to start to adapt with the culture. Okay? But yet in that whole process, she's drawing and her husband is drawing them away from the Lord. So Omri didn't care to serve the Lord. But what he wanted to do is he wanted to make his kingdom more powerful. And by doing this, he marries his son off to a powerful king's daughter. He moves his capital to a place that will make it a little more cosmopolitan and have a little more influences from sea trade and from trade routes and those kinds of things. Omri intended to open up Israel to these international influences, as we just said. Samaria was besieged and captured by the Assyrians. It was under siege from 724 to 722 BC, finally falling in 722, bringing an end to the northern kingdom. 2 Kings, we were looking at 1 Kings there, but 2 Kings 17 records this story. The Lord was angry with the people of the northern kingdom of the Israelites. Many of the prophets in the Old Testament prophesy against the idolatry and the injustices in Israel. In the 12th year of King Ahaz, king of Judah, began Hoshea, the son of Elah, to reign in Samaria over Israel 9 years, etc. And it goes on. Against him, verse 3, came Shalmaneser, king of Assyria, and Hoshea became his servant and gave him presents. And the king of Syria found conspiracy in Hoshea. After Hoshea decides that he doesn't want to pay the taxes anymore, he rebels. For he had sent messengers to So, king of Egypt, and brought no present to the king of Assyria, as he had done year by year. Therefore the king of Assyria shut him up and bound him in prison. Then the king of Assyria came up throughout all the land and went up to Samaria and besieged it 3 years. And in the ninth year of Hoshea, the king of Assyria took Samaria and carried Israel away into Assyria and placed them at Halah and at Habor by the river and in Gozan and in the cities of the Medes. What that we find is they spread the Israelites all over their kingdom. Okay, so the Assyrians, their conquest goal was, we're going to come in, we're going to conquer your land. If you come and pay us taxes, we're glad. You know, you'll be fine. Just pay me taxes. If you don't pay me taxes, the Assyrians were brutal. I mean, brutal. And they did this, I think we showed, you know, I had showed some of the pictures of the bas reliefs from the palace in Nineveh, where, you know, in there, you think of this, this is in your palace. And in your palace you have carvings of, okay, your great victory. But in the carvings of the great victory, you show somebody being skinned alive. Because guess what? This is propaganda. This says, when you come in to pay your taxes and you come before the great king and send your messengers, guess what you get to see on the walls? The battles we've won. And the pictures of the people we skinned alive. So don't forget to pay your taxes. That's how they worked. They were brutal. And then if you did rebel against them, then they came and they destroyed your city. They did all kinds of nasty things to the inhabitants of it. Sold people into slavery. Did all kinds of nasty things to them. And I'm not going to, you know, go into all the details of that. But then they would take them and remove them from their land and put them somewhere else. Because guess what? If you take a group of people and you move them somewhere else and you spread them all out, then they don't have that patriotism of land anymore. They're not in their homeland. And so it's harder for them to rebel. And this was the Assyrian model. And that's exactly what the Assyrians did to the ancient Israelites. Okay, these are the ruins of a Roman temple from New Testament times that's sitting on the hill of Samaria, and you can see the hill country of Ephraim in the distance there. Okay? The Jezreel Valley. So we have the hill of Morah, Mount Tabor, Megiddo, Jezreel, and Beth Shan. We're going to move through this a little faster, but again, hill of Morah is right here in the center. See this valley shaped, sort of, they say it's bird-shaped. If you can imagine, this is the head of the bird and the wings of the bird going this way. Okay? So we have Mount Tabor here. Hill of Moreh or Mount Moreh there, and then Mount Gilboa down here at the south side of it. Jezreel Valley, and you can see it heads off this way toward the Jordan Valley there. But I'm going to note here, see Nazareth right on this edge on the north side of the valley. Mount Carmel here, so you can look across. That was that picture we were looking at. You could look across. Okay, Kishon River flows down this way, or actually flows up that way toward the valley actually drains this way toward the sea. And give you an idea, we've got, you know, towns along this. If we go back up here, we've got Megiddo up here. We've got the town of Jezreel here, and we'll consider those. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to move through this a little bit faster. The Jezreel Valley has several names, including the Plain of Esdraelon, which is the Greek adaptation of it, and the Plain of Megiddo. The Jezreel Valley is a triangular arrowhead bird-shaped plain running northwest southeast. It goes from the Kishon River Pass at Mount Carmel in the west to the Beth Hagan Jezreel area in the east. Okay, so the Jezreel area here in the east. And from the Nazareth Ridge up in here, this is in New Testament times, the Nazareth Ridge of the western lower Galilee in the north to the slopes of Mount Carmel range in the south. Here's the slopes of Mount Carmel down here in the south. It's around 18 miles long and about 17 miles wide. It drains northwestward to the Mediterranean, up that way, toward the Mediterranean Sea. The Herod Valley is a small valley that goes from the Jezreel Valley in the west to the Jordan in the east, and from the hill of eastern lower Galilee in the north to Mount Gilboa in the south. This valley drains down toward the Jordan, and so we got the Herod Valley, the spring of Herod, and this valley drains this way, down this way. But it's kind of almost a part of the Jezreel Valley. There are many passages into the Jezreel Valley. The Megiddo Pass was the route of the trunk road, which went over the plain to Mount Tabor, where it went northeasterly through the horns of Hattin. So it came this way and came past Tabor and then came northeasterly and then up here in the Galilee is an area called the Horns of Hattin. We'll see pictures of that when we go through the Galilee. The Beth Shan and Herod Pass went between the Hill of Moreh and Mount Gilboa. So down this way we have this other pass that goes down this way into the toward the Jordan Valley. So the main trade route, you can see it coming up this way, comes past Megiddo, comes across the valley, goes up that way, but there was also a route that would go down here toward Beth Shan. All right? Important hills in the Jezreel Valley. Mount Tabor is on the northeast corner of the triangle about 6 miles east of Nazareth. So here's Mount Tabor, just north up here, okay? It is a symmetrically rounded summit, 1,800 feet above sea level. It guards the northeast pass to the Jezreel Valley. And we're going to see, here's an aerial view of Megiddo, and you can see how there would have been a pass that ran into the valley. You can see the valley out in the distance. View of Jezreel Valley from Megiddo, so you can see out here in the distance the Jezreel Valley. All right, and then again, here's the map of the Jezreel Valley. Nazareth up here on this ridge, Tabor, Mount Hill of Moreh, Mount Gilboa, and then Mount Carmel here on that end. Here's Mount Tabor. See how symmetrical it is? It's just a round hill. All right. It guards the northeast pass to the Jezreel Valley. Mount Tabor is where Deborah and Barak gathered Israel to fight Jabin and Sisera in the Jezreel Valley. So this is, they gathered here. This is the location there by Mount Tabor. And the Lord gives them the victory despite Barak's demanding that the prophetess go to battle with him. Tradition says that Christ was transfigured on Mount Tabor. Tradition. But it's more likely that this occurred in some part of Mount Hermon, which is up in the north of Israel, okay? So tradition says this is the Mount of Transfiguration, but a lot of Bible scholars think it's much further north, up near Caesarea Philippi, where Jesus reveals to his disciples, who do you say that I am, etc. That discussion goes on near Caesarea Philippi. We think that, I personally tend to agree with it, that it's probably not Mount Tabor, but get an idea of, traditionally this was a place that people thought might have been the Mount of Transfiguration. A second hill that we considered is, you can see Mount Tabor from Megiddo, standing on the tell of Megiddo across the Jezreel Valley. You can see Mount Tabor out in the distance. Another one, so Tabor is up here in the north, and we get the Hill of Moreh right in the center of the valley. Here's the Hill of Moreh. This one is a little more gradual slopes on it. The Hill of Moreh is located in the middle of the plain, just south of Tabor, about 8 miles north of Mount Gilboa. It is 1,700 feet above sea level. A little bit shorter, and it guarded the eastern pass to the Jezreel Valley. The village of Endor was on the north side of the hill. So over here where you see a settlement over here on the north side of the hill over here was where Endor was. When you see the name of a place and it's called N-E-N or E-I-N, that's actually representing the Hebrew word Ein, which means spring. Okay, it's the site of a spring. It's also the word for eye in Hebrew. They use the word eye and the word spring, and you could think metaphorically how that would work. Tears come out of your eyes, water comes out of the ground, it's like the ground is weeping. I don't know if they really thought of it that way, but the same word is used, Ein. So Endor, Eindor is the spring of door here on the edge of the Hill of Moreh. And this is where Saul went to meet the medium, or the witch, as she's called, prior to the Battle of Mount Gilboa, right? He goes to meet her. And finds out the Lord allows Samuel to actually appear to him and tells him, you're going to die in battle tomorrow. And the battle actually takes place here. So where I took this picture from, I was on a road, but, we were in the middle of the valley where the Philistines come and battle against the Israelites. The Israelites try to draw the battle up into the hills. They go up to Mount Gilboa because they can use the elevations to their advantage, and the Philistine chariots don't work so well on the hills. Philistine chariots work really well in these valleys, though, because you can get a lot of speed up. Chariots can flank you and do a lot of things. The village of Shunem was located on the southwestern base of the Hill of Moreh, so over on this way side. All right? And this is where Elisha raised the widow's son. The village of Nain was on the northern side of the Hill of Moreh, around over there. This is, again, if you think about this isn't that far from the Galilee. Jesus is in this region, and this is where Jesus raises the widow of Nain's son, according to Luke chapter 7. We'll consider some important cities in the Jezreel Valley, Megiddo. All right. In fact, the other name for this city is, or for this valley, is the Megiddo Valley, or the Megiddo Valley. Okay. In fact, the word, see this hill it sits on? The word for mountain in Hebrew is Har. So mountain of Megiddo is Har Megiddo. It comes into Greek as Armageddon. Okay. So the reason that Armageddon is called Armageddon is because that battle is going to take place around this Jezreel Valley area, okay? And a lot of battles took place in the ancient world there. Megiddo is located 7 to 8 miles southeast from the Kishon Pass at the base of Mount Carmel. It guarded the main road from the coast to the Jordan Valley. We've noticed that trunk road multiple times. And also overlooked the trunk highway that came from Egypt and ran northeast through the Jezreel Valley. The site of Megiddo contains the ruins of about 20 different cities, one on top of the other, as they were destroyed. It was a strategic location and was destroyed many times. The tell is about 70 feet high and covers 10 acres. So this is about 10 acres. To give you an idea, we have about 5 acres here and another acre over on the garage. So take the church property here and double it. That's about the size of the ancient city of Megiddo, the top of the hill, and then it's elevated. It was already probably a hill location, but then, you know, if the city gets destroyed, you don't move all the rubble. You just flatten it out and build the next. That just becomes your foundations. And so they, one pile after another, they just rebuild the city on the old. The Israelites were unable to drive out the residents of Megiddo in the conquest of the land. Judges 1:27 lists Megiddo as one of the cities that they were not able to drive the Canaanites out from. Solomon fortified Megiddo, according to 1 Kings 9:15. All right, he knew he needed to control that pass, because guess what? If you want to tax those trade routes, you have to control those trade routes, which means you need to have a fortified city along that trade route. So this fortified city worked as a place to collect taxes. Remember, Solomon becomes very, very wealthy controlling that trade route that really joins three continents. So if you wanted to come from Europe down to Egypt, you had to come through that area. If you had to come from Egypt down up to Asia, you had to go through that area. From Asia down to Egypt, you go through that area. All right? And the Battle of Armageddon will be fought in the Jezreel Valley, according to Revelation 16:16. I'll invite you to turn there and look at Revelation 16:16. What we see is, and he gathered them together in a place called in the Hebrew tongue Armageddon. So the Lord gathers these rebel armies together, and he gathered them together into a place called Armageddon. And the seventh angel poured out his vial into the air, and there came a great voice to the temple of heaven from the throne of God, saying, "It is done." And there were voices and thunders and lightnings, etc. And then we find this fall of spiritual Babylon here. And eventually we see the Battle of Armageddon. That final end times battle will take place. So again, these aren't just places where things happened in the Bible. This is a place where things are going to happen in the future and have been prophesied. Jesus is going to come again. And he's going to set up his kingdom. And he's going to defeat armies that are assembled to rebel against the Lord. And there's going to be this Battle of Armageddon, and it's going to be a slaughter. And interestingly, that the Bible actually rejoices in this slaughter, because it's the slaughter of the Antichrist and his rebellious army who are trying to rebel against Christ. Another town in this valley is the town of Jezreel. Let's look at some of the pictures of Megiddo. Here's the ruins of the ancient gate at Megiddo. You can see they fortified this gate. And you often had to walk up to a gate, you'd come and you'd have to make a left turn, because men were right-handed. It was considered a shame to be left-handed back then. They weren't all right-handed, but you were taught to be right-handed, and that would be what you'd use your sword with. So if you have to make a left turn and fight into the gate of the city, you're leading with your left side and trying to bring your sword around, so it's a disadvantage. So they made left turns into city gates so that it was harder to try to attack and assault the city gate. So you can see the fortifications of the city. Here's the entrance to the water tunnel. A good city that's going to be fortified needs a water source, or else they're just going to make you thirsty and you won't stay in the city very long. And so this is the tunnel that led down into the spring that fed the town of Megiddo. Here is the ruins of ancient Megiddo, all right? And we're going to look at this in just a second. Here's another picture of that. This is a high place in the Hebrew, Abama. Now, when it says they worshipped on the high places, that doesn't mean on mountains. It means on these things that they built. They would take uncut stones and stack them up and have steps up to them and have worship often to Baal or other deities on these places. So again, when you see it, it starts to make sense. But when you read your English Bible and say high places, you think they're going up on top of a mountain. And they didn't have to go on top of a mountain. They just built one of these Bama. Okay? And this is at Megiddo. And so we do know that after the time of Solomon, Megiddo is eventually controlled by Ahab. What kind of worship do you think took place here when Ahab and Jezebel controlled it? They were worshiping Baal and Asherah there. These are the ruins of stables. Now, why did they have stables there? Because this was a fortified city. And we know that Solomon fortified it. And we know that the kings of Israel stabled horses for their chariots there. If you're going to control the Jezreel Valley, you have to have some chariots. And so they stabled horses there, and we know from the ruins that this was meant for horses to be kept. And so there was a standing army of charioteers here at Megiddo. All right? And as we consider this, that's Megiddo. We come down here to the city of Jezreel, the ruins of ancient Jezreel facing Mount Gilboa. You can see the peaks of the range of Mount Gilboa in the distance. This This is the Tell that makes up ancient Jezreel. Okay, Jezreel is located about 18 miles from the base of Mount Carmel. Ahab made Jezreel the chief palace of the northern kingdom of Samaria. He built his palace here. Near the palace was the vineyard of Naboth. So he's in his palace here, and he notices Naboth has this really nice vineyard. Okay, so if we go here, we notice, you know, you got a really nice vineyard, and I want it. And, you know, he ends up killing the man and stealing his vineyard, and the Lord says that judgment comes on him because of that. Then we get the town of Beth Shan. So the Canaanite city. It's down here as we come through the En-Herod Valley down here, the spring of Herod here, down to this town of Beth Shan. All right? Beth Shan is located in the Herod Valley on the eastern side of the Jezreel Valley. It guarded the pass from the Jordan into the Jezreel Valley. So from the Jordan River up into the Jezreel Valley, it guarded that pass. Saul and his sons, their mutilated bodies were hanged on the wall of Beth Shan after they were killed on Mount Gilboa. Here's Mount Gilboa. Okay, and the battle took place here, and this is where Saul falls on his sword. And then the Philistines find the body, and they take his armor and his head, and they take it back to Philistia. But they leave the mangled body there, and the Canaanites from Beth Shan, who are enemies of Israel, come and take the bodies of Saul and his sons and hang them on their city gates. Okay, and then remember, men from Jabesh Gilead over here in the Gilead area come over at night and rescue the bodies, if you would, because it's a shame that the king's body is being displayed that way. Okay, here's Beth Shan. Beth Shan was also built as a Roman city, so you can see the Roman amphitheater. See this line of columns here? The Romans always had a street through their cities called a cardo, which was a main thoroughfare that was a straight street that they built. But here's the tell that makes up Canaanite Beth Shan. Okay? Here, and you can see over the time, this is the basalt rock that was kind of native to the area, but over time they also added some of this limestone that they had quarried elsewhere and brought in. But these are actually the entrance to the city gates. These are the actual stone walls that the body of Jonathan and Saul were hanged on. Okay? I mean, obviously you can see it's in ruins, so what the actual stones looked at that time. But this is the exact place where Saul's body was hanging from the wall. All right? So you hear these stories and you can imagine it, but you can actually go and see the place where this happened and then where the men of Jabesh Gilead came and smuggled their bodies out at night. Here's a look down at Roman. You can see the amphitheater out here, which we took the other picture from, the cardo here, and then standing on the tell looking down at the Roman version of the city, but on top of Canaanite Beth Shan. All right, and that gets us to the end of those pictures. But we will consider just briefly important events that took place in the Jezreel Valley. The victory of Deborah and Barak, we mentioned. The victory of Gideon over the Midianites. The deaths of Saul and Jonathan. The death of Josiah, we didn't really mention this one, but he goes out to try to stop Pharaoh Necho, who's going to try to aid the Assyrians in battle against the Babylonians, and he ends up getting killed because he doesn't do this by order of the Lord. And then the Battle of Armageddon will take place there. So not only are we looking at things that are going, that have happened biblically, but things that will happen. Here is a place where Jesus is coming back and he's going to win a great victory, and it's going to take place in that very valley. All right? It's a known place. We know where it's going to happen, and it's there in that Jezreel Valley, in that Valley of Armageddon. Jesus is coming again. That's a wonderful truth we look forward to. Let's pray.